But they danced there slowly in a grey light of dusk that was like pain and beauty, like the lost light under sea, in which his life, a lost merman, swam, remembering exile. And as they danced, she, whom he dared not touch, yielded her body unto him, whispering softly to his ear, pressing with slender fingers his hot hand. And she, whom he would not touch, lay there like a sheaf of grain in the crook of his arm, token of the world's remedy, the refuge from the one lost face out of all the faces, a thousand flitting shapes of beauty to bring him comfort and delight. The great pageantry of pain and pride and death hung through the dusk, its awful vision, touching his sorrow with a lonely joy. He had lost, but all pilgrimage across the world was lost. A moment of cleaving, a moment of taking away, the thousand phantom shapes that beckoned, and the high, impassionate grief of stars. Again, that is a typical passage of a euphoric sense of nostalgia and loss, which is absolutely typical of the writing in this work. And here I want to quote to you the very famous set piece, the death of his brother, Ben, in chapter, at the end of chapter 35. The figure of Ben in the book is very important, because Ben is the one member of the family who has travelled and got out, and is therefore very important to the young man. Gently, desperately, he tried to detach her fingers, that is the mother's fingers, from Ben's hand. Her rough clasp on the cold hand tightened. Then slowly, stonily, from right to left, without expression, she shook her head. He fell back, beaten, weeping before that implacable gesture. And suddenly, with horror, he saw that she was watching her own death, that the unloosening grip of her hand on Ben's hand was an act of union with her own flesh, that for her, Ben was not dying, but that a part of her life, her blood, her body was dying. Part of her, the younger, the lovelier, the better part, coined in her flesh, born and nourished and begun with so much pain there 26 years before, and forgotten since, was dying. And then he falls asleep, in fact, beside his dying brother. He awoke suddenly, conscious that he had slept, with a sharp quickening of horror. He was afraid that the little fluttering breath had now ceased entirely, that the effect of his prayer was lost. The body on the bed was almost rigid. There was no sound. Then unevenly, without rhythm, there was a faint mutter of breath. He knew it was the end. He rose quickly and ran to the door, across the hall and a cold bedroom on two wide beds. Gant, Luke and Helen lay exhausted. That is the father and the brother and sister. Come, cried Eugene, he's going now. They came quickly into the room. Eliza, that's the mother, sat unmoving, oblivious of them. As they entered the room, they heard, like a faint expiring sigh, the final movement of breath. The rattling in the wasted body, which seemed for hours to have given over to death all of life that is worth saving, had now ceased. The body appeared to grow rigid before them. Slowly, after a moment, Eliza withdrew her hands. But suddenly, marvellously, as if his resurrection and rebirth had come upon him, Ben drew upon the air in a long and powerful respiration. His grey eyes opened. Filled with a terrible vision of all life in the one moment, he seemed to rise forward bodilessly from his pillows without support, a flame, a light, a glory, joined at length in death to the dark spirit who had brooded upon each footstep of his lonely adventure on earth. And casting the fierce sword of his glance with utter and final comprehension over the room, haunted with its grey pageantry of cheap loves and dull consciences, and all those uncertain murmurs of waste and confusion fading now from the bright window of his eyes, he passed instantly, scornfully and unafraid, as he had lived, into the shades of death. And then the opening passage of the book, this is the very end of the book, is repeated in a new context, that passage I read to you just now about the door. And it ends, we can believe in the nothingness of life, We can believe in the nothingness of death and of life after death. That is, there are no schemes, as I say, like that deterministic structure. But who can believe in the nothingness of Ben? Like Apollo, who did his penance to the high god in the sad house of King Admetus. He came, a god with broken feet, into the grey hovel of this world, and he lived here a stranger, trying to recapture the music of the lost world, trying to recall the great forgotten language, the lost faces, the stone, the leaf, the door. And so the end of the novel comes right round to the beginning again. That is that Ben's final vision is absolutely silent. That what appears to be his final experience of what is called comprehension, final and utter comprehension, is absolutely silent. And that goes back into the extraordinary noise and capacity for living of this book. And that's why at the end it is absolutely appropriate, he says, that trying to recall the great forgotten language. That great forgotten language then at the end of the book stands for the unspoken coherence, which Wolfe always felt it was the writer's job to find words for, but you never could. It's an endless search for the forgotten language of coherence. And that's how, in fact, the book ends. Images, then, of forgotten language is what we're concerned with in this book. But you can see the kind of way he writes. It's full of enormous vitality, coarse energy. There's no attempt to tame it. It just gushes out. And as you can imagine, the defenders of this book and the opponents of it are just radically opposed. I don't know anybody who either doesn't hate Thomas Wolfe or, like, in my intensity, doesn't seem to be any middle way here. You either like that kind of thing or you don't. I know a lot of people who find it completely repulsive. I may say I'm on the extreme other side. I think it's terrific. But then I like this kind of rhetoric very much when it's done well like this. I think we're trained to be very, very, you know, cagey about, and this kind of thing is very often called overwriting, you find in, like, you know, observer critics and things. What that really means is they don't want to be disturbed. But I think the most important things I've said already about this, the structures, I don't particularly want to think. There's one other thing I want to say, that is the angel in the title. Look Home with Angel. The angel in the title is a very important image. W. O. Gant, the father of Eugene, is a sculptor of graveyard statuary. And this stone angel represents his unfulfilled ambition to be a great sculptor. It's a stone angel as an adornment of a prostitute's grave in the town. And it stands for the possibility, always present to the boy, that youthful idealism may not be fulfilled. This is a very, very unsentimental book indeed, whatever the style may look like. There is this, then, in the father, W.O. Gant, in his own life, in the boy's father's life, the representative of the search, the quest, what happens to idealism? What is the nature of betrayal? It's very beautifully done, I may say, particularly at the very, very end of the book, where you can see the sense of, it's the last two or three pages, you can read for yourself, where this stuff about the father is given a really strange, powerful quality of the declined idealism. So there is that too. But I think the most important thing to leave you with is the fact that finally the boy gets out and goes to college. Goes to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So the book has that structure. It's like born into a small town like Asheville, North Carolina is, surrounded by hills, your family come from the hills, they come down into the area, they build up inside this house the inheritance area. Two huge figures, the mother, who runs the house as a boarding house, who handles the money, who has enormous passions, plus the father, a gigantic man who's a sculptor with this huge failed ambition idealism. Inside the family, too, figures like Ben and Helen. And the way Helen plays the piano is like most of them eat. I mean, there's this sort of big bashing at it. You know, and I thought this enormous exuberant energy is there. And that draws the boy in into an extremely tight, controlled area of passion, of hopelessness, of tears, of struggles, and so on. So that he knows he's got to get out, and at the same time, he knows that getting out is going to be like tearing part of your own flesh. And it's this long build-up in the novel to the point where he has to get out, and how the getting out is described, which is the central line, if there is one in it, the core, the sort of armature. So that there is, in fact, a traditional pattern, very much so, of the voyage out from the security area, which is painful. That is the central mystical plot, I think, of the structure. And the next stage in the series, which I can't go into, is not moving out from the small town and from the country background around it, the hills, to the university, but moving to the city. So I have to place all this in a big context, and that is something we've seen already. That is the moving of the boy from the small town or the country area into the very large metropolis. And that is the next stage in this sequence. That is the movement from, the opting to move from the small town to the university to the city quite deliberately. Now, Wolf did it himself. He became for a time an instructor at New York University, the Washington Square One branch. So there's a renunciation thing going on in this structure, the renunciation of the southern town, renunciation of the security of the family and its non-security, and the renunciation of the forest and the hill in the last part of the book, images, and the desire to get on that train and move north, away from the south, and the south there standing for the agrarian, the local, and the provincial. And the north standing for the world. That is the mythical structure of the thing. Okay, that is the kind of thing in this kind of book then. Next term, as I said, we've done the, I've been lecturing fit to bust on Fitzgerald, Hemingway, and Faulkner, so we have a clear run now of the poetry. What I'm going to do next term is just four sessions, no more. I may do three if I get really sort of cheesed off a little. But so that if you could kindly look at Hart Crane's The Bridge and Huso and Rudyard Pound and be familiar with some of the Carlos Williams materials. If you don't know what to read, I suggest you just look at Book One of Patterson. It's a huge poem called, in five books, called Patterson. Patterson.
Which is the poem?
Huso and Mobley. It's a poem sequence called Huso and Mobley. You've all got the list, haven't you? So if you could read The Bridge, which is the poem sequence, and Huso and Mobley, and if you do, I don't really mind what you read of Williams. It doesn't really matter. Part one, book one of Patterson would be very nice. Can I get it? Then we'll consider those three poets together. And if there's any more time, as I said, if anybody wants to have a go at anybody else of the major poets of that of the modern poets, just let me know, I'll see to it that we find a bit of time on it. Okie doke.